For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, controversy surrounding State Senator Rick Brinkley results in the powerful lawmaker resigning his leadership positions, which include chair of the Pensions Committee and assistant majority floor leader. The Owosso Republican faces charges of embezzling $1 million from the Better Business Bureau. Neva, what are your thoughts on these accusations?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think, number one, the resignations were appropriate, and I think it certainly was an effort on the part of both Senator Brinkley and through his attorney to make sure that this didn't spill over and become just an unnecessary issue for the caucus and for Republican leadership. So, you know, I would applaud that as being a very positive point that took place. In terms of all that is starting to unravel and be in the public eye in terms of his problems, the lawsuit by the Better Business Bureau, and certainly the fact that OSBI has, since January, it's been a fairly common, you know, understood point, at least around capital circles, that he was under investigation. There seems to be the looming indictment, in the making. And, you know, until everything comes out, I think what we have to wait and see is what transpires. We may ultimately see something very much like Senator Gene Stipe. We may see something where a deal is brokered in part that removes him from public office and makes it where he would never run again, and whatever else ensues in the aftermath of that. But I think the long and the short is he's probably it's probably going to transpire fairly quickly. I think some of these sidebar issues, like the use of the campaign funds, whether that gets into the mix, may be secondary to these bigger issues on the embezzlement.
Ryan, should he have resigned completely as a senator, or is the leadership enough?
No, I think that the decision as to whether to resign as a senator, that needs to come a little bit later down the line. I wouldn't be advising him to resign at this point. I do think stepping down from the committee chairmanship positions and the leadership positions within the caucus makes sense, both from a political standpoint and from a litigation standpoint. I mean, he's going to be in a very difficult position over the next year or so as he hunkers down and deals with civil litigation. I think it's very likely that we're going to see criminal charges. You don't have an investigation that goes on that long in these kinds of allegations where there probably aren't criminal charges. The range of those, I think, is up in the air. But you know, this is something that ultimately could get to the point where it makes it impossible for him to do his job as a senator. And at that point, I think that it would make sense for him either to resign or, if the timing is right, to not run for re-election. And you know, we're talking about somebody that was the heir apparent to Brian Bingaman, the Senate President Pro Tem. I mean, he was, and that's before we went on the air today, we were talking a little about term limits. And you know, in this era of term limits, you have people that were, you know, first came to the Senate in 2010. Isn't that right? 2010. So he comes to the Senate in 2010, and he's on the fast track to lead the Oklahoma State Senate, which is a big deal. You mentioned Gene Stipe, and I won't take Gene Stipe's name in vain by trying to compare this with that. But the difference there is that you had a senator who had decades of political power and wisdom that he'd accumulated in the Oklahoma State Senate, and with a very long and storied political career. Here we have somebody who has been on the scene for about 5 years, and was about to take over the state Senate. So I mean, how epic this battle will be in the grand scheme of Oklahoma's political history probably isn't that great, but you know, certainly for him and his district, it's something that could have a big impact on their world.
And certainly his position, being basically one of the heir apparent to the Senate President Pro Tem, this could be quite a shakeup, at least for those who follow the inside baseball of the Capitol politics.
Right. And clearly, it changes the whole dynamic because it was pretty commonly viewed among many in the Republican Senate circles that he was the heir apparent. It wasn't an absolute given, but it was certainly the strong thought process up until all of these revelations. So, you know, I think it will make for interesting political gamesmanship through the summer as all of this begins to further unfold.
The gamesmanship will unfold. I mean, you've got this power vacuum now, and with term limits, and you have to, if you're interested in those positions of power, either in the House or in the Senate, those leadership positions aren't something that you get because you've been there for decades. It's something that from day one, you almost have to, from day one walking in that building, say, I want to be Speaker of the House. I want to be president pro temp and start working towards that goal.
Working towards that and having the ability to garner a significant amount of support from your colleagues, and that oftentimes some aspire to the high places, but don't get there because they are not able to really command that leadership potential.
Mm-hmm. A Tulsa law firm, which represents 300 school districts, calls the law banning teacher union dues from coming out of paychecks unenforceable. Attorneys point to language which would actually affect the Oklahoma Education Association and others. Ryan, what are your thoughts on the way this bill is being read?
Well, I think that the law firm is absolutely correct. You've got a bill that very clearly says that it only impacts organizations that engage in collective bargaining. OEA does not engage in collective bargaining. It says that organizations that bargain under federal law, the entities that, even if there are entities that work with OEA, they're bargaining under state laws. I mean, so you've got, I think, two very big problems with this bill and whether or not it can be seen as effective. I don't think that it can be enforced against OEA payroll deduction the way that it's written. I like Representative Tom Newell, the way that he responded to questions about this was almost, don't blame me, I just work here. He says, I'm not an attorney. We had a lot of attorneys looking at this stuff. It's wonderful now, and correct me if I'm wrong. Please, somebody email KOSU and let them know, or find me on Twitter and let me know if I'm wrong. But I'm going to bet that Representative Newell is among the handful of lawmakers that have criticized the Affordable Care Act and said that certain parts of it are unconstitutional, or the King v. Burwell case that's going to come out later this month, dealing with a few words in a 1,000-page bill. Here you've got a couple of words in a 2-page bill. All right, so this is a 2-page bill, and there's not a lot of context to read this and find a way that makes it workable. So I don't think it's going to be enforceable. They're going to come back next year, and that's fine with Representative Newell and the folks that supported this, because it's a political softball that they get to crush out of the park and affect political payback on their political opponents.
Neva.
Well, Ryan's exactly right. I mean, it is unenforceable. It's clear. I mean, OEA, I mean, they're 35,000 members statewide. They do not collective bargain. It's the payroll deductions for membership dues is clearly proper and legal. And I think the fact that they've kind of teed this up and made this clear to these school districts now so that there's not confusion as they come back in for the next school year is certainly appropriate. And, Ryan is right. I mean, this is one of those cases. I mean, it barely eked out of committee on a 4-3 vote in the Senate committee. I mean, there were a lot of questions. There was a lot of push, and there were a lot of external factors injected in from groups that really wanted to kind of make this point and kind of poke the unions in the eye, so to speak. And what they have now is a mess that they're going to have to come back next session and clean up language and clarify and decide whether they want to fight this fight again in a political season. And I think there's some question whether that's going to be as easy to do next time as they attempted to do during the most recent session. So, I think the long and the short is it's unfortunate when we try to play the political, rhetoric game in posing it into law, and then, with everyone really questioning at the time the legality and all of these issues that have come to light since then, they would have been better served to have stepped back and if they wanted to fight this fight, do it at least on proper legal grounds.
And then also costing as far as the state, if this goes to the Supreme Court, then the state has to defend it. And so you've got more cost there to the state.
Here's a real easy way to avoid it going to the Supreme Court, though. Don't try to enforce the law. As long as we don't have school districts out there refusing to do payroll deduction for OEA, the Oklahoma Education Association, as long as we don't have folks out there doing that, then there's no controversy. There's nothing to take to a court. So, I would just implore the school districts of Oklahoma to not waste dollars by trying to enforce this unenforceable law. Follow the advice that these 300-plus school districts are getting from the Tulsa law firm and not try to enforce this law.
Conservative think tank, the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs, is criticizing claims by Republican leaders that they are cutting spending and reducing the budget. Now, the OCPA says the budgets over the past 3 years have actually been the same relatively with few reductions. Neva, does this organization have a point?
Well, they have a political point, and I certainly think that they're trying to ramp it up on some of these lawmakers and make the case that their point is, look, you come, you say, I want to right-size government. I want to make the tough decisions. I want to deal with the budget. And then here we go again. There's very little change, and the budgets, you know, are basically staying the same. They're not shrinking. They're not the numbers are not going down. So they have a good point. Obviously, the spin meisters on the other side, you know, have been able to wheel and deal and suggest that yes, there have been in fact some reductions or shrinking in the budget. It's all in the eye of the beholder. But I think the bottom line is, it doesn't take away the point that I think we made all through the legislative session, and that is that lawmakers, this notion that somehow next year it may be better, somehow next year it may not be quite as tough, or we may not have these difficult decisions facing us, is just not realistic. And I think that voters back home are going to get some fatigue on the idea that that they can hear political rhetoric during the campaign season and yet see not real results during the legislative session. So I think it's one of these a little bit of a slippery slope when you look at the elected officials posturing versus the think tanks and others, you know, really kind of laying out the numbers here and saying, okay, you all make your own decision. And I think it's interesting what the voters will say at the end of the day.
Ryan.
Well, and I think that Neve is right. You know, we've watched the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate, and now, you know, the control of, you know, virtually all statewide offices. You know, many of these folks in leadership positions have been running on this idea of right-sizing government. And at some point, if that's what you're running on, you actually have to do it. And what we've seen is, rather than make those really tough choices, because it's real easy out on the campaign trail to talk about government waste and inefficiency and how we're gonna make things run on a leaner ship, but then when you get to the Capitol and you say, okay, well, we're gonna, you know, cut education, or we're gonna have a standstill budget in education. Even a standstill budget is a cut if you look at increasing class sizes, increasing mandates, increasing overhead cost. You know, things don't just stay the same price every year. It's called inflation. We all deal with it, and inflation for government items is higher than the inflation that you and I pay whenever we go to Target. Right. So, you know, we see all of these things happening, and nobody really wants to make the tough decisions. And we saw that this year again, where the legislature, rather than making deeper cuts, because they already made pretty deep cuts just by the nature of things, but rather than making deeper cuts, used a bunch of one-time funding to try to patch holes for ongoing obligations. You know, it wasn't like we were patching a hole in a roof and walking away from it. You know, we were using that money for ongoing obligations. So it's really going to come home to roost next year. And I think, you know, legislators can only do this for so long before the people of Oklahoma recognize that you cannot have your cake and eat it too. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, and it's interesting. One of the things that OCPA pointed out, I mean, they made their case that there are many non-essential spending elements that could be, you know, that could be cut. I mean, they talked about promotional trinkets and advertising and memberships, and their figure that they attribute across all agencies is something around the neighborhood of $40 million. Now, you know, again, as they start to talk specifics, $40 million is not, you know, not a small pile of money in the context of, you know, these budget holes that they're mm-hmm. facing. So I think, you know, I think that it's interesting that over the last two decades, when you really, you know, go back and look at these budgets, supplemental spending has increased every single time. And I think, you know, again, we have this posturing of, you know, some elected folks wanting to say, well, we don't know whether we're going to have supplementals, and others saying it's a given we're going to have supplementals. So I think until they really rein in and start drilling down into these budgets agency by agency and not talking about just top line numbers, they're never going to see some real substantial shrinking in the state budget.
And on the flip side of that, we're going to need to see more. And we already see some of it. The Corporation Commission came out last week with some things that they were going to be limited in doing because of these new budget numbers that were just passed by this legislative session. But I think agency heads are going to have to do a better job of communicating what those cuts mean for the delivery of services. That doesn't necessarily mean that because those services are going to be cut that we can't ever cut services. I would hope that we don't. But if your job is to right-size government, you want to live within your means, and we have a tax structure that creates a very limited means to meet these obligations for the people of Oklahoma, at some point you have to cut it. And those agency heads, I know nobody wants to be the captain of the Titanic to, you know, announce to the world that you've hit an iceberg and you're going down, But at some point, you've got to be able to communicate what those cuts actually mean, rather than trying to paint a very rosy picture of your agency's operations, when in fact, things aren't going so well.
Well, that's true. But on the agency side of it, I think you also have agencies who have been given a lot of latitude and a lot of discretion on how they work their budget. And some of those folks are going to have to be more realistic on prioritizing within the framework of their own agencies what needs to be bumped up, and some things that are going to have to be eliminated. I mean, it's very difficult for them to want to say, oh, we're not going to fill FTEs. We're not going to, we're not going to expand this, that, and the other. And that's where they have to be proactive in trying to be part of the solution, not just coming to the legislature every year saying, oh, no, we don't want a standstill budget. We don't want to cut. We need more. And that's not realistic in the environment we're living in.
Finally, battle lines appear to be appearing over embattled Republican Party political director T.C. Ryan. Defenders of the operative accused of domestic abuse are now attacking GOP leaders and legislators. Neva, this appears to be more Republican infighting. What's going on here?
It is. It's continued infighting. I think what we may see, there is discussion that the Republican State Committee may come together before the end of the month at a regularly called State Committee meeting. Some are trying to put together a resolution that basically would say, by order of the State Committee, if passed, that it would call for T.C. Ryan not to serve in any official capacity or hold any position of authority in the Republican Party. And this would include, consulting part-time. It basically would eliminate him from being someone involved in any capacity officially with the Republican Party. There seems to be a growing sentiment that this is necessary, that they would like to see it. A number of Republican leaders, county party leaders, and others across the state. Whether it materializes remains to be seen. Oftentimes they talk about it and it never becomes a reality, but it does seem to have traction in it. And I think what underlies all of that is addressing this one issue and getting it out of the way this summer or early fall so that they don't have it lingering on into the campaign season, when many folks, including legislators up for reelection, who also have votes on the state committee, have to address this, or at least have to talk about it. I think a lot of folks would like to see this go away and not be an ongoing, lingering issue out there. Interestingly enough, it seems to be focused now almost exclusively on T.C. Ryan and not on Randy Brogdon, right, the state chair. And ironically, if you want to inject another element to this whole equation, Randy Brogdon, who held the seat that Senator Brinkley now holds, is already talking about the possibility and being encouraged, and has said publicly he's being encouraged, if that seat becomes vacant in a special election, to perhaps run again, because he wasn't term limited. He left to run for higher office. So a lot of different moving pieces in this equation, and it's classic party politics. I wouldn't say it's Republican or Democrat. I think Ryan would probably concur that, over the years we've seen a lot of this kind of thing happen, and it's inside baseball, but it makes for great chatter on blogs, mm-hmm, and a lot of in a slow summer season it makes for good political talk.
And Ryan, Republicans are finally at the point where Democrats were a couple of decades ago, having such a large majority that you basically now are just fighting amongst yourselves rather than fighting between parties.
Yeah, but I can't remember a time in Democratic Party history where somebody was excommunicated from the party, from party activities. I mean, and we've had
official party activities.
Official party activities. I guess unofficial party activities, whatever those are. Do you report those to the Ethics Commission? How do you report that? And it's not like, we're a party of a bunch of Boy Scouts. So,
we've had our fair share as well.
Maybe there are some folks that should have been excommunicated, but I think that it's kind of interesting to look at. Neva's right. At the end of the day, what impact does it have on state policy? Probably not, if any, as it shouldn't. And we're in the post-Citizens United world where many of the primary functions that parties used to take on, both Republican and the Democratic Party used to take on, are being taken on by super PACs, by candidate-centered campaigns, by organizations, by nonprofits. These are everything from organization to advocacy to get out the vote to mobilize it, whatever it is. message building, policy work. Those are all things that are being done outside of parties today. And in many instances, the restrictions, especially funding restrictions that exist upon parties, and then the structure, and then sometimes you get the soap opera drama stuff, you can avoid a lot of that. By going out and starting your own entity,
super PAC.
And
exactly.
Your own super PAC.
Exactly.
And you know, I think that I don't want to say that parties are totally irrelevant or that they should be totally irrelevant, but stuff like this really adds to the argument for anybody that's out there debating about working within a party structure or working outside of a party structure. Sometimes it's just easier to do your own deal.
And I think it is a problem not only in Oklahoma but across the country.
I mean,
parties are grappling with identity, and they're grappling with what their focus and priorities should be. And I think if they get back to basics, I've always maintained, you know, parties have a place in the process, in the political process, but they don't need to be all things to all people. And that's where you get too many competing lighthouses, you know, in the framework of the process, and it doesn't work. And that's where the other side of the coin is that you have to have strong leadership that can unite at least a majority of these individuals within a party to march in whatever particular direction at the time they all agree to. And I think that's where in Oklahoma, I think for both parties, I mean, that they need to focus on what they can do to best carry their message and reinforce electing the folks that are running on their particular party label.
And if you're the party in power, yeah, I think that obligation is even higher. I mean, you're not just a political party. You're a governing party.
But if you're not the party in power, then your job is to try to become the party in power.
Right.
And that means working within your own party to do that.
And building that leadership necessary.
And maintaining credibility with the public at large that basically have tuned out the process and feel like it is not really relevant in this day and age. And that's where the real challenge, I think, is.
And we can talk about voter participation later on. Fantastic. Thank you very much. Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.